It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Don't speak, bitch. Come on now.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
This is episode 877. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, September 1st, 2024. I am the Solo Monster. The day after the Bash in Berlin, 6 days before AEW All Out, and less than a week removed from the death of one of the biggest wrestling stars of the 90s. We've got a lot to talk about, and I will be devoting a lot of time to Sid Vicious. That'll be later in the show. I want to thank you all for your support throughout the month of August. Summer is over. Unofficially, but it is over. We turn the page now to September. Let's make this an even stronger month. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to shout out all of my PayPal producers on the first day of September, including Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills. Michelle, thank you very much. Big B, Brian Becerra. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lamphere, The Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton, Tough Guy, Temjin Zephyr, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Best in the Game, Trey Porter, Killshot, Keith Hart, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. I hope I get to see you, brother. This is a busy week coming up. I'm going to be live after Raw on Labor Day tomorrow night. We got Tuesday night Titans. I'm live on Wednesday night after Dynamite. Then Thursday, I fly out to Chicago for House of Glory, our Chicago debut. The first three rows are all sold out. General admission tickets are still available, though. HOGWrestling.net. If you can't be in Chicago, you can stream the event live on Triller TV. Mike Santana defends the HOG World Championship against Dijak, making his House of Glory debut. Zilla Fatu will make his first defense of the Crown Jewel Championship, but it won't be easy. He's going to be taking on Mustafa Ali. Megan Bain defends her HOG women's title for the first time against Kylie Rae. And we got a lot more than that. I hope I get to see some of you there. We also have Joe Hendry coming to HOG on September 29th. He may be the NXT champion after tonight. And just announced, the legendary Masato Tanaka comes to HOG for the first time ever on Friday, October 18th. Then this Friday, I'm going to be back here for the SmackDown Post Show. And then Saturday, for the third straight weekend, we have a pay-per-view, AEW All Out, and then another podcast on Sunday. So the work never ends, which is why I appreciate all of the love and support that you guys throw my way. It means a lot. NXT has its No Mercy show tonight in Denver. I know I don't review the show weekly anymore, but I do keep tabs on what's going on and try to check out all the big shows, especially as we get closer to their debut on the CW network, which is only a month away now. This is the card as it stands. We have Wes Lee, who had a heel turn recently, going one-on-one with Zach Wentz. That Rascals reunion was short-lived. So Wesley is a heel now. This should be a win for him because the goal should be to get him over as a heel, not to get Wentz over. NXT Tag Team Championship on the line. Chase U against Nathan Fraser and Axiom. Andre Chase and Ridge Holland, they just won the belts 2 weeks ago. I don't see them dropping them right back. And also, you know, good to see Ridge Holland having some success here in NXT. I think this is the best place for him to be right now. He seems to be doing well. NXT Women's North American Championship on the line. Kalani Jordan defends against Wendy Chu. Kalani Jordan has beaten Tatum Paxley, Rosemary from TNA, and now she faces Wendy Chu, who has been doing a dark gimmick since she came back from her injury. So they're throwing all the spooky ones at her. I'm going to say Wendy Chu wins the title. I think this is going to be a title change here. We have Oba Femi defending the NXT North American Championship against Tony D'Angelo. I've had people writing into me. I've had people tweet me send in super chats asking me about Obafemi, telling me that Obafemi is him. He is him. He's been very impressive from everything that I've seen. He's had some really good matches. I've seen with people like Wes Lee and Dragon Lee and Dijak. I think he had a TV match with Ivar once that was pretty good. This should be another good outing for him. I think he retains. I don't really see any reason to take the title off of him right now. Roxanne Perez defends the NXT Women's Championship against Jada Parker. Roxanne should enjoy her run while it lasts because Julia is on her way. In fact, I think that Julia shows up tonight, right after this match. And then she wins the title from Roxanne on one of those first two shows on the CW network next month. That's when I would do it. Get the biggest possible audience that you can and book that match on either October 1st or October 8th. October 8th might be the more preferable date because that's going to be up against AEW that night. And then we have the NXT champion, Ethan Page, defending his title against Joe Hendry with Trick Williams as the special guest referee. I think we need to stop and appreciate for a second here what Joe Hendry is doing right now. He's over in two different promotions. He is signed to a TNA contract, but is making regular appearances every week on WWE programming. And his stock has never been higher. I mean, now, if I'm Shawn Michaels, I would want to strike while the iron is hot. But then I would also remind myself he's a TNA talent. And Trick Williams is going to get that NXT championship back soon. When he does, do you want him to walk into a situation where he gets a mixed reaction up against somebody else's star? Or do you want to put all the heat on Ethan Page and make it all the more sweeter for Trick when he beats him to win the belt back? That would be the smart play. Because you got to look at the big picture here. Ethan Page is going to retain the NXT championship. I'm not even saying that Joe Hendry has a 0% chance. TNA talent have not fared very well in the win-loss column when they have made appearances and wrestled in NXT. It hasn't usually gone very well for them. I am not going to tell you there's no chance or no shot that they might just say, fuck it, even for a short run, we're going to put Joe Hendry as our number one guy and we're going to put our championship on him. It would be so unlike anything WWE would have done. But then again, it's a new era. It's a new era. It's no longer the Vince McMahon era, but I actually think in this case, it would be smarter to keep the title on Ethan Page for all the reasons that I just mentioned, because I do think Trick is going to win the belt back in short order, and it should be from Ethan Page. I don't really see the benefit to him if it ends up being from Joe Hendry, but what a trip it would be if Joe Hendry wins the NXT championship before he ever wins the TNA title, which is the company that he actually works for. I just don't see it happening. And they need to be careful, too, with how they do the finish, because Trick is the referee. You don't want it to blow back on him if he counts the fall for the heel champion that people hate. But, I mean, it's not like we haven't seen this before. We just saw it at SummerSlam with Seth Rollins counting the fall for Drew McIntyre. There's a way to do it. I'm sure Shawn Michaels knows this already. He's been around for a while. But that's how I see it playing out. There was a scare for a lot of people who work and train at the Performance Center on Tuesday when WrestleVotes tweeted that, according to a source, there was an all-employee meeting today at WWE headquarters in Stamford hosted by Mark Shapiro. Now, Shapiro, for those who don't know, he is the president of Endeavor. He is the COO of TKO. Anyway, he says, I'm told the biggest news to come out of the meeting is that the WWE Performance Center will be moving to Las Vegas in the near future. Now, this came out of nowhere, and it was news to the folks at the PC, too, who were completely shocked and appalled and caught off guard by the tweet. Sean Ross Sapp followed up that his sources at WWE and TKO said they are not planning to move the PC to Las Vegas, that Shapiro was merely making a point about Vegas as a destination, and that having a presence there is on the table. Now, Vegas is where UFC is headquartered. They also have the UFC Apex there, which is where NXT ran its Battleground show back in June. And there were a lot of complaints about how small it was, even from people that were in the venue. Dana White has said the Apex is undergoing a $25 million expansion. So I absolutely expect to see more NXT shows there in the future, but completely uprooting their developmental program and moving it cross-country to Vegas, it's just hard to envision. I mean, they have so many people based out of Florida, talent-wise, both main roster and developmental. Like Florida is like, it's their hub. It was certainly their hub during the pandemic shows when they were based down there. They use a lot of main roster talent on NXT, you know, and many of those talents are based out of Florida, so they have easy access to them. That wouldn't be the case in Las Vegas. You know, if they were to completely shift everything to the West Coast, it would be a huge lifestyle change for a lot of them, and I wouldn't be too happy about uprooting my life either, especially if I had just moved to Florida to work at the PC. Now I find out that, hey, we're going to move to Vegas. Yeah, I mean, not that I have anything against Vegas, but I wouldn't be too happy about that either. So I'm sure a lot of people there were very upset when they heard about this and angry finding out about it on Twitter. That, you know, if it's true, nobody would have given them any sort of heads up. But it doesn't sound like anything is imminent. WrestleVotes did follow up, said that he reached back out to his source after the Fightful report, and that source is still confident in the initial report about moving to Vegas. Said he's also told this is not an overnight thing and it could take some time. Meltzer claims, just calm down the laughter, Meltzer claims that he heard back from someone in WWE that there would likely be a developmental system based in Vegas, but it wasn't clear if that meant there would be two of them, so one in Orlando and one in Vegas, or just one in Vegas. Having two different PCs, you know, one on the East Coast and then one on the West Coast, that actually would make a lot more sense to me. Maybe have an NXT Orlando and have an NXT Las Vegas and switch back and forth with the TV tapings between locations every few weeks, or, you know, once a month or something, just to give it some variety. That I could see. I think the more likely scenario would be having two locations for developmental instead of just the one. I just can't see them shutting down the PC and forcing everyone to relocate out west. You know what Vegas would be a great destination for? Talk about what a great vacation destination Vegas is. That would be a great location for a physical Hall of Fame. More than even developmental. That's what I would like to see. It's been long enough. You're going to have a physical Hall of Fame. Vegas would be a great place for it. WWE hosted its Bash in Berlin yesterday, which now holds the record for the highest grossing arena show in company history anywhere in the world. And that's on a crowd of just 13,000 fans. They have routinely done more than that for Raw and SmackDown this year. So you can imagine what they must have been charging for tickets for this show. I heard from a couple of listeners in Germany, one of whom wanted to go to the show with his family, but he took one look at those prices and he said, nein. He wasn't going to that show. They did the same thing in France. You know, it's weird. And I said it then when they did it on the Backlash show. It's weird to send their announcer out to the ring, as they did on Saturday, to announce that we basically raked you people over the coals, and everybody cheers and goes, yeah. You know, thanks for helping us make history. Like, it's one thing to go out there and say, hey, we set a new attendance record. We set this record. We set that record. The highest grossing event, the highest gate in company history. And everybody cheers. But the prices they were paying. And look, hey, you know, WWE can charge what they want. If the market dictates they can get that amount of money and there's enough demand for it, then hey, you know, they're in the business to make money. But it's just a weird thing to go out there and gloat about and have everybody cheering. But they were loud all night for the show, which I thought was very good. I thought it was a fun 3 hours, very predictable, which is a recurring pattern with these international shows. There's nothing truly shocking or surprising about anything on these shows. That doesn't mean it's bad. It wasn't a bad show, but you can script the show out in your head before it even starts. Cody Rhodes and Kevin Owens, they had a stellar match, with Cody retaining the WWE Championship after Kevin went soft. He went soft. He couldn't bring himself to go after Cody's gimpy knee. He lacked the killer instinct. That the Kevin Owens of old, he wouldn't have lacked that killer instinct. And in the end, it cost him. And he knew it when the match was over. You could see it written all over his face. Even though he hugged Cody, they left together. This is not over. I think a heel turn now feels more likely to me now than it did 24 hours ago. I think a heel turn is coming, and I'm kind of glad we didn't get it here because they can milk this for a few more weeks. You know, Solo Sikoa has said that he wants next. Whoever wins in Berlin, Cody Rhodes, Kevin Owens, it doesn't matter. He wants next. I have no appetite for another Cody Rhodes Solo Sikoa PLE main event. I have no desire to build this up for October. We just started September. I don't want another month of building up Solo Sikoa for a WWE Championship match. But before we get to Bad Blood, there are no PLEs this month for WWE, but SmackDown is moving to USA Network in 2 weeks. This is the final SmackDown this coming week on Fox. Praise be the wrestling gods. I think they do Cody Rhodes against Solo Sikoa on September 13th for the title to give that show a big main event. That's what I would do. You want to do that match? Do it on that show. Get it out of the way on that show. And then I think on that show we get the return of Roman Reigns, which is why he is no longer being advertised for it. I think they want to save him as a surprise. And if they really want to hit us with a shocking moment, after Roman, let's say, fights off with Solo and the Bloodline, we get the full-blown Kevin Owens heel turn. And that then leads to one more match between the two of them at Bad Blood. Now, I know that pushes off any Cody Rhodes-Randy Orton story for a while if they do that, but they need heels on that show. They need heels for Cody. Orton could be one later on. KO can be one right now. And when Cody is done with him, we could get Owens and LA Knight in a program for the U.S. title. I mean, I'm just looking ahead now to, you know, what Owens would do if he did turn heel but then lost to Cody. Who else is there for him to work with? LA Knight would make a lot of sense. I wasn't sure we were getting a heel turn at all for Owens, but I'm more convinced now than ever that it is coming. Bianca Belair and Jade Cargill, once again, women's tag team champions. The only reason Alba Fyre and Isla Dawn won the titles in the first place in Scotland was because Drew McIntyre was losing to Damian Priest. They wanted to give the fans there something to cheer for. That was it. They got a little run out of it, and now the belts are back where they were always intended to be. And I believe the only reason they even have those belts is to build to whatever split is coming for a WrestleMania match between Bianca and Jade. We've got a few more months left to go before that split happens, but I do think that's where we're headed. CM Punk won his first WWE match in more than a decade with his strap match victory over Drew McIntyre, and he survived. He survived the match. He did not get hurt. That's two matches in a row now that Punk has gotten through without breaking or tearing anything. See, that's a good sign. He even took his bracelet back at the end of the match. I like this better than their SummerSlam match. And now the two of them are all knotted up, one win apiece. Punk, after the show, said that, I think he was talking to Kathy Kelly, and he said that he was done with McIntyre, which is the same thing McIntyre said about him after he beat him at SummerSlam. He said he's done with McIntyre. Now he's gunning for the World Heavyweight Championship. He put Gunther and Randy Orton on notice. This fucking guy. He wins one match in 10 years, and he thinks he's ready for the title. Who does this guy think he is? I think Drew McIntyre will have something to say about that. He may end up as unhinged as Hangman Page is in AEW when it comes to Swerve Strickland. And I think that's how we end up getting them both inside Hell in a Cell at Bad Blood to blow off their feud. Right? Maybe he'll take a page out of Swerve's playbook. You know, go to Chicago. Well, when I say Swerve's playbook, I mean what Hangman did to Swerve. Maybe McIntyre will go to Chicago. He can break into the man's home. He can stalk AJ Lee. He can dognap Larry. Right? We know that'll get to Punk. Right? It's like calling Marty McFly chicken in Back to the Future. He wants to really get under Punk's skin. Just go ahead and dognap Larry. Hopefully he doesn't do to Larry what the Big Boss Man did to Pepper. Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley both lost at SummerSlam. They came out as winners in Berlin over Dominic Mysterio and Liv Morgan. Really fun match. Rhea pins Liv, which should set her up for a rematch for the Women's World title. They're saving that riptide. They're saving that riptide on Dom, I think, for Bad Blood. Damian Priest likely going to get Finn Balor on that show. And Gunther walked into Berlin as world heavyweight champion for his very first title defense. He walked out of Berlin as the world heavyweight champion after an excellent match in the main event with Randy Orton. Just a great professional wrestling contest between these two men, right down to the respectful handshake when the match was over. Their last match at the King of the Ring was mired in controversy. There was no controversy here. This was a decisive win for Gunther by ref stoppage, with Orton going out in the sleeper hold. The atmosphere for the match was great in front of that crowd. Orton had a smile on his face that had to be surgically removed. He looked so happy. He shouldn't be happy, though, that he remains winless in PLE matches in 2024. How might that factor into his return to SmackDown? How many more losses is he going to tolerate before he finally snaps? The story of this match for me, I said it in the review yesterday. And thank you to everybody who joined me on Saturday afternoon. The story of this match was the selling. Gunther with the bad wrist, Orton with the bad back. This was the best selling I have seen in any match all year. These two were fantastic. And what I appreciate about Gunther and the way that he's booked, he doesn't take any shortcuts. He doesn't have to cheat. He doesn't need people constantly interfering on his behalf. I think Ludwig Kaiser interfered in one match that he had all year. It was a TV match with Sheamus. He's a heel who gets under people's skin. He takes personal digs at them and their upbringing, as he did with Damian Priest, and their family, as he did with Randy. He talks a lot of shit, but he backs it up. And when the match was over, he put his hand out and Randy Orton shook his hand like a man, out of respect. It's just so unlike how WWE has traditionally booked top heels. It's refreshing. So again, I thought it was a fun 3 hours. There's a pattern that they have with these five-match international shows that Triple H has been booking. It works for them. How long it will work for them? I think it'll work for them as long as they can continue to find international locations that have not had these big shows before. I think Italy is probably prime for one in 2025, and any other places that they think they have an audience that they have not gotten a show like this before, they will continue to run these locations and you will have these rabid crowds so that when they come back to the States and we have Raw on Monday night, it doesn't quite feel the same. I think these American crowds, man, they got to up their game. We now have a date for the Raw on Netflix debut, Monday, January 6th, 2025. I'm sure Chris Jericho's wife will be front and center in the front row for that show. That is when Raw moves off of USA Network and moves to Netflix, which announced this week that its long-planned docuseries on the life of Vince McMahon is finally set to premiere, and we won't have to wait very long. It's going to be dropping on Wednesday, September 25th, titled Mr. McMahon. The series will consist of 6 one-hour episodes. The project has been in development for a while. It's been in development since 2020, and it was a very different series back when it was first conceived. Not that Vince did not already have skeletons in his closet. They were out in the open even back then. But along the way, this series has evolved given the events of the last 2 years. Think of everything that has happened in the last 2 years. It's unbelievable how different this company and how different the wrestling business is in just the last 2 years. You know, given everything that happened with Vince, him going away, the company being sold. It's unbelievable. I wasn't even sure Netflix was still planning on releasing the series. But it's produced by Bill Simmons and Chris Smith, who is the executive producer for Tiger King. The poster for the series describes McMahon as both a mastermind and a madman. I've been calling him the Irish madman for years on this show. They got Vince to sit for over 200 hours of interviews for this, all of which came before the first Wall Street Journal story broke about the hush money payments and the Janelle Grant sex trafficking lawsuit earlier this year. All the interviews were done before that, but this is the full synopsis that Netflix put out. Mr. McMahon chronicles the rise and fall of Vince McMahon, controversial businessman and co-founder of WWE. From his transformation of the WWE from a small regional business into a global entertainment powerhouse to the explosive sexual misconduct allegations that led to his eventual resignation, this 6-episode series offers a deep dive into McMahon's life and his enduring franchise. Culled from over 200 hours of interviews with McMahon himself prior to his resignation, his family members, business associates, and some of the most iconic names in wrestling history, as well as the journalists who uncovered McMahon's allegations, filmmaker Chris Smith and executive producer Bill Simmons present an unflinching, no-holds-barred look at one of the most enigmatic figures in sports entertainment. The goal behind Mr. McMahon was to pull back the curtain, and reveal the true Vince McMahon obscured beneath the persona he presented to the world, according to Chris Smith in a press release. Over the 4 years of production, the story evolved in truly shocking ways, culminating in some extremely harrowing allegations. The final product is a revealing documentary that we believe offers a rich and nuanced portrait of the man and the complex legacy that he left behind. Complex is certainly one way to put it. It's a shame that he's such a slimeball, because his story is a real rags-to-riches one, you know, growing up in a trailer park in an abusive household. And yeah, you know, he did take over an already established, successful territory from his father. It's not like he started it from scratch, but he did bank everything on that first WrestleMania. He, you know, and it paid off. And he did take the company national in ways that I'm sure his father probably wouldn't have wanted him to and could only have dreamed of. And you see what he was able to turn WWE into. But all of that is just overshadowed by the last couple of years. You know, his legacy is forever stained. No matter how great of a promoter he was or how great of a heel he was, and he was, he is the greatest heel in the history of the business. But his name will forever be associated with Sexual Deviant. And I also feel like if he was a trustworthy source of information, if he put out a memoir, it could have been fascinating. Like all the stories he could tell, think of all the talent he's worked with over the years. I'm not even sure he remembers most of it, but if he did, and if I could actually bring myself to believe what he says, it's kind of like Hogan. If Hogan was actually trustworthy, his book could have been a must-read, but I don't believe anything the man says. You know, with Vince, I'm very curious to see what he talked about in these interviews, how specific they get with certain things. It's only 6 episodes. I'm not expecting them to ask questions about specific wrestling angles. I mean, that's not what this is. But Bill Simmons has been very chummy with WWE over the years. He's very friendly with the people that work there. I did enjoy the Andre the Giant documentary he produced for HBO several years ago, which is not to say there weren't sides to Andre that were not addressed in the documentary. If you want to hear more about that, just go ahead and pick any shoot interview you can find other wrestlers who work with him. But and they needed WWE's cooperation on that project to be able to use all the footage of Andre, but they tried to keep it, I thought, as accurate as they could, and they didn't just parrot all of the legends and the myths when it comes to Andre's life. So I enjoyed that documentary, but it's also the same Bill Simmons who suggested to Nick Khan last year that he bring Test back to WWE, not realizing that Test has been dead for 15 years. So how in tune he may be with certain things, that's an open question. But this is coming out in only a few weeks, and it's only a few months here before Raw moves to Netflix. One shouldn't really have anything to do with the other, with Vince no longer being affiliated with the company, but that doesn't mean that it won't, or that they may not gloss over certain things that should not be glossed over. So I'm keeping my expectations low for this. But we'll see how it turns out. I'll be watching, and I'm sure I'll be reviewing it here on the show. Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, which hosted this year's WrestleMania, posted a short Q&A video on Twitter, and when asked about some of the exciting events planned for Philadelphia during America's 250th anniversary in 2026, he highlighted several events, including WrestleMania, which was news to WWE. He said, get this, in Philly, we've got the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, we got the FIFA World Cup, we got WrestleMania, we got a little golf action, the PGA Championship, and if you go over to Pittsburgh, we've got the NFL Draft and a lot more cool stuff happening all across Pennsylvania, in the year 2026 for USA 250. Now, at first, I too thought that maybe he misspoke. Maybe he was referring to Philly having just hosted WrestleMania this year as a sign of all the great events that are coming to the city. Or maybe he said WrestleMania, but he's not really a big wrestling fan, and he could just be using that as kind of a catch-all term, and maybe it's in reference to another big event that's coming to Philly in 2026. But here's the thing. If it was a stadium show, which it would be, there's really only three options: Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, and SummerSlam. Maybe Elimination Chamber, since they ran a stadium show in Perth this year. But there's no way they're running a stadium show in January or February on the East Coast. Okay, that's not happening. And we know already that SummerSlam in 2026 is coming to Minneapolis. So that would leave only WrestleMania. Mike Johnson said on PW Insider, and speaking to several within WWE, they were across the board pretty surprised by Josh Shapiro's mention that WrestleMania would emanate from Philadelphia in 2026, noting that it was not something that had been discussed internally. We were also told by a well-placed source who would be involved that the location for Mania in 2026 has not been locked in stone as of this writing. Shapiro, or whoever handles his social media, later took down the video, the old tweet and delete, and it turns out he just got it wrong. A spokesman for the governor issued a statement a few hours later saying, "This statement was mistaken, and we apologize for the confusion amid all the incredible events Pennsylvania is excited to host in 2026. While WrestleMania will not be here in 2026, we look forward to continuing the work with WWE and wrestling fans all across our Commonwealth to bring more great events to Pennsylvania in the future." So that ends that. Because I know some people saw that video or saw the news articles that came out of it, and they may still think it's legit and didn't see the follow-up. The follow-up is that there is no there there. There is no WrestleMania in 2026 in Philadelphia. 2 years would have been an awfully quick turnaround to bring WrestleMania back to Philly when there's so many other places dying to host the show and bidding for the show. And plus, you got to remember, Nick Khan made it very clear after this year's show. Remember how people were complaining about how cold it was that first night in the stadium? And it definitely looked it. I mean, it definitely affected some of their crowd reactions. He said they would not want to run another stadium in the Northeast again in early April. If they did, it might mean moving Mania that year to later in the month, which they're already doing next year in Vegas. I mean, that's going to be the latest WrestleMania we've ever had. It's the 19th and the 20th. Or possibly running WrestleMania in early May in the future, which I think it will happen eventually. If they end up coming back to the Northeast, I could see a first week in May, maybe like a Cinco de Mayo themed WrestleMania. I could see that. It's also very risky to be putting something like that out there so early, as we've seen with Minneapolis. They thought they had it in the bag. They thought they were getting WrestleMania 8 years ago. They're still waiting. The Tennessee Titans president on record is saying WrestleMania is going to be in Nashville in 2027 in their new stadium. When he said that, that was before the Endeavor deal was made official. Any kind of agreements like that pre-TKO, you could throw them out the window. There's no guarantee they're going to stick to those plans. You know, Triple H and Nick Khan, they met with the mayor of London a while back about bringing WrestleMania to London for the first time. You know, it was never stated for what year that might be. And don't forget, the Saudis want it too. They've met with WWE as well about bringing WrestleMania to Saudi Arabia. It all comes down to money. If Philly were to make WWE an offer they can't refuse, then they're going to get another WrestleMania. If the Saudis make WWE some ridiculous offer to bring WrestleMania overseas for Riyadh season, then guess what? That's what they're going to do. In fact, WWE is making a foray back to Saudi Arabia in November for Crown Jewel. That's on November 2nd. We found out this week that they will also, while they are there, be taping an episode of Raw for the first time ever in Saudi Arabia. So Crown Jewel will be on November 2nd. They're going to be taping an episode of Raw the next day on November 3rd. That will air that Monday, November 4th. Frankly, I'm surprised it's taken this long for them to do this. It would seem to me to be a lot more convenient for the talent than having to fly right back to the States and then head to whatever city Raw is going to be in that Monday. Talent and production. I would think that they're thrilled about this. I know I would be. Last Sunday, AEW held its biggest show of the year, All In, at Wembley Stadium. I got the podcast up a day early because of the pay-per-view, so I didn't get a chance to comment on it here on the flagship. But I thought it was overall a great show, better than last year's show. Jamie Hayter is back, finally. Ricochet is All Elite. No surprise there. But it was highlighted by two of the best matches I've seen all year, in Bryan Danielson against Swerve Strickland, which was a five-star affair all the way, and MJF against Will Ospreay. Once again, Will Ospreay, the international champion, and he won it with the Tiger Driver that he has refused to use since nearly crippling Bryan Danielson with it at Dynasty. Bryan Danielson coming out on that show to the final countdown, beating Swerve Strickland to win his first AEW championship of any kind, winning it the same way he won the WWE title at WrestleMania 10 years earlier with the LaBelle Lock. Only this time he had his wife and kids in the ring with him to celebrate. He called it the greatest moment and his new favorite moment of his entire career, which set some people off on social media because how dare he? How dare he call it that? Surely he must be mistaken because Oliver Douchebag on Twitter says that WrestleMania 30 is the greatest moment of his career, so it must be true. It would be funny if it wasn't so sad. Mariah May also wins the AEW Women's World Championship from Toni Storm, which means that both winners of the Owen Hart tournaments this year went on to win gold at All In. Very much like the King of the Ring and Queen of the Ring this year, both winners went on to win titles at SummerSlam. Winning these tournaments matter. They should matter. Remember that for next year. Bryan came out on Dynamite, and he teased retirement. Even though he won on Sunday, it was title versus career, and he won. But he was teasing retirement. He said, it's time to go home. But not yet. He's going to continue to fight for that title and defend it. And when he loses it, that will mark the end of him as a full-time performer. He will be full-time so long as he is the AEW World Champion. So I give it another 5 weeks. At the most. I give it until WrestleDream. Then he threw out the challenge to any young, hungry talent in the back who wants to try to take it from him. Which confirms, by the way, what we already knew, that the ranking system that Tony Khan reinstated earlier this year, something I told you would be a fail the minute he brought it back, is officially dead. There are still people, I will occasionally see people on Twitter, they'll tweet Tony, are the rankings still a thing? Can you give us an update on the rankings? What are the rankings, Tony? You can stop now. There are no rankings anymore. That's why you haven't seen a graphic in 5 months. You know, it's one thing to do an open challenge for the TNT title, or like LA Knight right now on SmackDown is doing one for the US title. To do one for your world championship, there are no rankings. Jack Perry accepted his challenge. He came out from behind. He laid Bryan out in the middle of the ring. He stood there with his arms outstretched, TNT title in one hand, AEW world title in the other, like he was Brock Lesnar after he beat John Cena that one time at SummerSlam. If Brock Lesnar was shot by the laser beam from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, you would end up with Jack Perry. Would he have been my first choice? No. If Danielson is throwing out open challenges like that and we don't got to worry about who's in the rankings anymore, I would have preferred Nigel McGuinness step up and shoot his shot since he hates Bryan so much. And I thought Nigel looked great in that Casino Gauntlet match. First time he's been back in the ring since 2011. It's like he never left. But I don't hate it the way that other people do, this choice of Jack Perry. And it actually makes sense. You might not want to hear it, but it makes sense. Jack Perry is the TNT champion. That makes him number two in this company. And he wants to be the world champion. Jack Perry has a pinfall win over Bryan Danielson from Anarchy in the Arena. Bryan needs an opponent to beat in his first defense, which is only a week away. Well, now it's less than a week. That does not leave any time to build a real story. The story is already there with Perry pinning him before. And he'll get super heat with it being in Chicago. So I don't see what the problem is. This is not, you know, building up Solo Sikoa for 2 months for a world championship match at SummerSlam that almost nobody wanted to see. This is Jack Perry in the main event of All Out on 10 days' notice. It's like ripping off a Band-Aid. You rip it off quickly, it'll be painless, and it'll be on to the next one, which is Darby Allin at Grand Slam. But don't forget, Christian Cage, he won the Casino Gauntlet match, which gives him a guaranteed shot at the AEW World title. And they are utilizing, it sounds like they're utilizing Money in the Bank rules for it this time, where he can cash in for his shot at any time. So you've got Christian lurking in the shadows, and given how slimy his character is, I don't see him calling his shot in advance. I don't see him coming out and saying, hey, you know what? Bryan Danielson, I want to challenge you in a month at WrestleDream. Like, it's not going to work that way. When the time is right, he's going to slither in, and he's going to try to win that title. I honestly don't know when he may cash in. It could be All Out. It could be Grand Slam. I'm not even sure he's going to win. But as far as when he attempts to cash in his shot, I don't know. I don't think Danielson loses that title before WrestleDream, you know, when they get to Tacoma. Maybe there. I don't know. But let's run through this All Out card for Saturday, because we've already got six matches official for this show, which is basically a full card. Not an AEW, it's not. They'll probably add more. Well, probably. Of course they're going to add more. But I would add one or two more on TV this week, and then they'll be rock solid. I really don't think they need more than that. But of the six we know of, Willow Nightingale defends her CMLL Women's World Championship against Chris Statlander in a Chicago street fight. Statlander pinned Willow in an eliminator to earn the shot. Willow and Tomohiro Ishii beat Statlander and Stokely Hathaway on the pre-show last Sunday to earn the right for Willow to pick the stip. She chose street fight. I like both of these women. I think it's going to be a hard-hitting match, very physical, and I think Willow retains her CMLL title. MJF steps into the ring against Daniel Garcia. Garcia returned it all in during MJF's match. He stopped him from using a foreign object. Not the Dynamite Diamond ring, because the ring was legitimately either stolen or misplaced, which is why they had Garcia concoct that story on TV about pawning it in Buffalo so that he could fly himself to London. What is Tony Khan paying this man that he has to even do that? The question I think needs to be asked. Then on Dynamite, he was just, you know, Garcia was full of fire and rage when he went after MJF. He challenged him to this match. He said, making Max's life miserable is his fetish. You keep your fetishes to yourself, buddy. Okay? If he really has not signed a new contract yet with the company, then he should lose. Even if he has signed a new contract with the company, he should still lose. MJF should not be losing back-to-back matches in the span of 2 weeks. If Garcia has signed a new deal, and you want to try to make a new star, and Tony Khan is serious about giving this kid a push, great. You have MJF win here. And you play this out until WrestleDream, or you play this out until Full Gear, and he can win there. For now, I've got MJF winning on this show. Mercedes Moné defends her TBS championship against Hikaru Shida after Shida won a four-way match on Collision last night to earn the shot. Scariest thing I saw all weekend was Thunder Rosa nearly breaking her fucking neck on a detox by Serena Deeb. She tucked her head on the landing. I have no idea why. Thankfully, she got her foot out in time on the landing to sort of cushion the blow on her neck, or else that would have ended very badly. You remember when Yoshitatsu got his neck broken on the Styles Clash? I think it was on a New Japan show. Dude was in a halo for months. He had four holes drilled into his skull. He was tweeting about bleeding out of two of them in the middle of the night. Horrifying. I still haven't forgotten about that. You're not supposed to tuck your chin like that. There's no story here. She just became number one contender last night. So, I mean, how much of a story could there be? I saw that Mercedes, I didn't see the match, but I did see that she had a great match with Momo Watanabe at the New Japan show on Friday night for her New Japan Strong title. She's had other great matches too, Mercedes has. Her match with Britt Baker last Sunday was not one of them. I wonder what the common denominator here is. That's better left in the past. I expect her and Shida to have a really good match. Mercedes is not losing that title. Will Ospreay defends the international championship that he just won back against the Bastard Pack. This is going to be a fantastic spectacle of a match. I'm sure also very polarizing, but I'm very much looking forward to seeing what these two do in the ring together. I want to say they've had one other match before on the indies a number of years ago, so not a ton of history there, but these are two fantastic in-ring performers. Will Ospreay is, I think, the best in the world, and Pac is no slouch himself. So they're going to have a great match, but we're not getting a title change. And Pac just won the Trios titles with Claudio and Wheeler Yuta, so he's already one third of the Trios champs. He's not walking out with the international title. What they did do on Dynamite on Wednesday, though, Ricochet had his first singles match against Kyle Fletcher, who had a match. I have to say this. He had a match. I watched Collision. I actually watched Collision last night. And I had dinner. It was after the Bash in Berlin stream, and I had a late dinner, and I was stuffed. I didn't want to move. I was stuck. So I said, let's watch Collision. So I watched Collision. There's one reason to watch Collision. So I watch Collision, and I'm watching Ishii, and I like Ishii. And I'm watching Ishii against Kyle Fletcher, and they start this match, and they just start firing off forearms. And we've seen this a gazillion times. We see it with forearms. We see it with chops. We've seen it with Ishii. We've seen it with Minoru Suzuki. We see it with other talent, too. And they go back and forth, and they're no-selling it, and they're just throwing, you know, forearms back and forth like nothing. This was the longest. I thought it would never fucking end. It was the longest sequence of just throwing random shots at each other and no-selling it that I've ever seen in my life. And I just kept waiting for Kyle Fletcher to start selling it and start getting woozy on his legs, or Ishii or somebody. Eventually, Kyle, you know, took the brunt of it. But I shit you not, this was just going back and forth, never ending. And I'm like, what is this? What is this? This is supposed to be entertaining. What the fuck am I watching here? This is where this shit jumped the shark for me. So whatever they were trying to do there, it didn't work for me. And I just mentally checked out for the rest of the match. Then FTR had a match on this show, and they picked up the win, and then the Grizzled Young Veterans came out and attacked them after the match, as they did at Wembley. And they attacked them, and they gave Dax Harwood a high-low. This was the worst high-low I have ever seen in my life. I certainly hope they're not going to incorporate that into more of their matches, because if they do, that's a bad idea. If they're gonna pull it off the way they did here, I mean, it was comical. It was almost like they didn't want to touch him. They touched him in the lightest way possible. It looked horrible. So I'm watching some of this stuff, and I'm like, you know what? I'm starting to realize why I don't really watch Collision on a weekly basis anymore. And then, of course, I mentioned the four-way match, which had Thunder Rosa almost break her neck. So it was quite the night. But at least the streak of injuries on Collision came to an end. Remember we went through that period of like four straight weeks of people getting hurt on the show? Sky Blue got hurt, and Dalton Castle got hurt, and like one or two other people got legitimately injured. At least that streak is over for now. But to go back to this, Ricochet wrestled Kyle Fletcher on Dynamite. Technically, it was the main event. They didn't close the show with it, but it was the last match on the show. So he got to main event his first night in on Dynamite. And then Will Ospreay came out on stage. So it was like, boy, we're going right to Final Jeopardy here. Tony Khan's not wasting any time. And before Will could say a word, Pac attacked him from behind, gave him a poison rana on the stage. And Pac welcomed Ricochet to AEW and told him, get to the back of the line. And then he went to the back, and Ricochet went up to the stage to go check on Will. So I'm not expecting Ricochet to be involved in this match, but I do wonder, are they going to go to Will Ospreay and Ricochet this quickly? Because it kind of feels like that's the plan here. So I'm wondering if we might get that match at Grand Slam or Wrestle Dream. And then maybe we'll end up with a three-way after that. Imagine Will Ospreay, Ricochet, and Pac in the ring all at the same time. That'd be something. And then Bryan Danielson defends the AEW World Championship against the TNT champion, Jack Perry. Again, I just talked about this. I don't mind it. It's not my first choice, but the way people are hating on this, dude, again, they had a week to promote this fucking show. It's ridiculous that they have 2 weeks between them. At least we had 2 weeks. Last year, it was 1 week. But on short notice, to get somebody in there for Brian to beat, somebody who is going to get a ton of heat, in Chicago. It's fine. Bryan Danielson is going to win. He is going to successfully defend his title against Jack Perry. And in the match that I think should main event the show, this is the real main event for All Out. Swerve Strickland challenges Hangman Adam Page inside a steel cage. This is a tricky one because Swerve winning and then getting a rematch with Danielson at WrestleDream to me is the most obvious way to go if they want to get the belt back on Swerve. And Hangman loses yet again to Swerve because he just can't beat this man no matter what he does. But how long is he supposed to go around doing this unhinged character for? Like, at some point, the man has to win. There has to be a payoff for him to all of this madness. He has never beaten Swerve before. He lost to him at WrestleDream. He lost to him in the Texas Deathmatch at Full Gear. He submitted in the three-way match for the title at Revolution just so Swerve wouldn't win. Right? And look at what he's done since he's come back. He failed in the Owen Hart tournament. His team lost in Blood and Guts. He lost in the Casino Gauntlet last Sunday, which was tailor-made for him to win. I think he's finally getting back in the win column. I think he's finally going to exercise his demons. He's going to finally notch that first win over Swerve Strickland. I think Hangman wins the cage match. Because this is not the end for these two. Even after this, they're not done. What if Hangman wins here? Goes on to challenge Bryan Danielson for the title at WrestleDream. Wins the championship. And to get his belt back, Swerve has to chase. It's no longer Hangman, as obsessed as he is, chasing after Swerve. Now the shoe's on the other foot. Swerve has to chase and beat Hangman to get his belt back. It doesn't even need to be Bryan and Hangman one-on-one on that show. It may well end up being a four-way match on that show with Darby and Swerve thrown in there as well. Get all the Washington State guys involved in the main event. Darby has got a title match coming up at Grand Slam, but he's also got Jon Moxley searching for him now for some reason. We may not even get a clean finish to that match. Darby could very well end up in that WrestleDream main event also. But Hangman wins the title there. Either way. And again, Swerve needs to take it from him if he wants to get his belt back. Hangman needs this win more than Swerve does. I think he gets the win, and I think they should close the show with it. Now, I mentioned Jon Moxley. Jon Moxley was back on Dynamite after not being there at All In to celebrate with the other members of the Blackpool Combat Club after Bryan won the belt. I don't think he is with the Blackpool Combat Club anymore necessarily. I guess we don't know, but it kind of felt that way to me. He seems to be teasing a new group. We saw Marina Shafir walk off with him in a segment in the back later. But in his promo with Tony Schiavone, he told Tony, who always has Tony Khan in his ear, "This isn't your company anymore." And immediately, everyone thought of Shane McMahon. Are they teasing some sort of AEW invasion led by Shane? How would that even work with Jon Moxley involved? Moxley is as much an AEW guy as he ever was a WWE guy. He's been there for 5 years. I mean, at least when Hogan turned and you had the NWO invasion, Hogan had been there for what, 2 years? Moxley is part of the fabric of this company. He's been there since nearly day one. He is an AEW guy. Through and through. So what would be the idea even behind some sort of invasion? We'll have to wait and see. It's an interesting little tease that they left us with. You know my thoughts on Tony bringing Shane in. It'll get people talking for a few weeks, and then it's going to wear off. Ultimately, it comes down to the story. Can they draw people in with the story? They tried with the Elite angle, and they failed. So they're trying something else here. I don't know if Shane is going to be involved or not. Tony Khan is not a stupid man. You could say a lot of things about Tony Khan. You could say about, you know, decisions he's made and booking decisions and things of that nature. He's not stupid. He knew that is the first thing that people would think of when he conceived of this. When Jon Moxley went out there on TV and said that line, he did it because he knew people would think of Shane. So my guess is, yeah, he's probably coming in. Now, the idea that I floated on the stream the other night was finding a way to tie it into the new TV deal. When they're ready to announce that new deal, tying Shane's signing into that in a storyline sense. Tying his signing into that to, you know, explain like the network wanted him there. Well, why is Shane here? Why is he even allowed to be here? Maybe the network, Warner Brothers Discovery wanted it. Something along those lines. That might be one way to explain it. As far as that deal, though, still nothing new to report on that end. Now, one more AEW note. Swerve Strickland has signed a new deal with the company that will keep him there through the year 2029. That's a great signing for AEW. Swerve is now a main event player. He is someone they can continue to build around. Not as the only guy, but he's one of their primetime players. And he has put the work in, so he deserves all the success he gets. Meltzer reported that it was well known that WWE tried to make a play for him and Prince Nana. And I think a lot of people took that to mean that they made a play for him recently. Like, before he signed this deal, WWE tried to swoop in and sign him, and how could they have done that? That's tampering and all this stuff. That's not how I read that. I took that as a reference to when they allegedly tampered and Swerve went to AEW management to let them know. He went to legal to let them know what WWE was doing. That was a while ago. That was maybe a year ago, maybe more. And I saw Raj Geary, he went on Twitter, he was mocking the idea that WWE would tamper and would do such a thing, and Swerve then tweeted back at him and said, hey, you want to see the text messages? And Raj quickly deleted the tweet. He does that a lot. Tony Khan has talked about WWE tampering with people under AEW contract before. I believe it. I'm sure that Swerve is not the only one. But the other thing that Meltzer said in The Observer was that Swerve's deal is believed to be among the biggest deals in terms of financials in all of pro wrestling. He claims the deal is well ahead of the last one that Kevin Owens signed with WWE, and that was a 3-year deal with escalators in it to where he'd be making $3 million in his final year. I think that's what he's making right now. So what he's saying is that Swerve's deal, supposedly, is bigger than that. And that a source in WWE allegedly told Dave that they feel the deal for Swerve and the offer that Tony made to Daniel Garcia are bad for the sport because they are so far over and above what WWE would perceive the market value to be for both men, with the idea that Tony is spending more than he needs to and he's raising salaries. Which is rich, coming from the same company that was offering high six-figure deals to each member of the Revival and Gallows and Anderson just to try to keep them from going to AEW. Have we forgotten about that? Have we forgotten about all the money they were throwing at people in the mid-card to keep them from signing with AEW 4 years ago and 5 years ago? WWE does not dictate what their market value is. The market dictates what their market value is. The market value is whatever someone is willing to pay. Is Tony Khan overspending on certain people? Probably. I don't know what he's offering Daniel Garcia, but I wouldn't blame WWE if they weren't willing to outbid Tony Khan for his services. I wouldn't either. But if Daniel Garcia can get that money from Tony Khan, then that's great for Daniel Garcia. This is why competition is a good thing. Tony knows what his numbers are. If he felt like offering big money to Swerve and to Daniel Garcia was going to bankrupt his company, he wouldn't do it. He may end up having to make cuts if he doesn't get the money he's looking for on that television deal. That TV deal is going to tell the tale about whether or not he can continue to spend big on free agents and if his company is ever going to be profitable. That's for him to worry about. But if Dave is to be believed, and somebody in WWE did say this to him, and if this really is the attitude of some of the people who work there, they're going out there every month waving their dick around about their latest gate record and getting $1 billion from Netflix. They've got a lot more money to work with than AEW does. But please, go on and tell me why paying Swerve Strickland $3 or $4 million a year is a bad thing for the sport. Wait until some promoter comes along one day and offers health insurance to the talent. Then WWE can cry about why that's bad for the sport, too. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. I was talking before about the new Vince McMahon docuseries coming to Netflix in a few weeks. You want to hear something that'll blow your mind? Netflix has more than 18,000 titles globally, but less than half of those are actually available to watch in the U.S. You're paying for Netflix and missing out on literally thousands of shows and movies. That is, unless you use ExpressVPN, like I do. Netflix hides content from you based on your location. How ExpressVPN allows you to get around this is it lets you change your online location so you control where you want Netflix to think that you're located. They have servers in over 100 countries, so you can easily gain access to thousands of hours of content and never run out of stuff to watch. And it's not just Netflix that it works with. It works on other streaming services too, like Disney+. What makes ExpressVPN the best VPN? For one, it's easy to use. You don't need to jump on YouTube and scroll for instructional videos on how to use the damn thing. Just pull up the app, click one button, and change locations, and you're done. That's it. It also works on all your devices, phones, laptops, tablets, smart TVs. You all have smart TVs, right? You don't have dumb TVs. If you do have dumb TVs, you need to buy yourself a smart TV. It's 2024. What are you doing using a dumb TV anyway? But that's the beauty of it. Even if you don't have one, it'll work on all your other devices. It's super fast, too. There's a reason it's rated number one by top tech websites like CNET and The Verge. I've mentioned that The Dark Knight is my favorite movie. I absolutely love it. But it's not on Netflix in the US anymore. Hasn't been for a while. I actually have it on DVD, but it's a pain in my ass to plug in my DVD player. You know what I did? I used ExpressVPN to switch my location to Australia, and I watched The Dark Knight on Netflix in Australia. I love playing around with it to see what I can get access to. And when I saw that, I said, you know what? I think it's time for a rewatch. And literally, all I had to do to unblock the movie was open ExpressVPN, select Australia, tap one button to connect, refresh Netflix, and there it was. Anybody can do it. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. If you were to ask me to build the perfect pro wrestler, I'm talking based on physical appearance. Sid Udy is what he would look like. 6'9", 300 pounds, big, tall, intimidating guy, even with the little orphan Annie curly hair. Maybe the best look for any pro wrestler that I've ever seen. You would look at the guy and think, how could he not be one of the biggest stars in the history of the business? Another wrestler from the era that I grew up on, gone too soon. Sid went by a lot of names in his career. Lord Humongous when he was first starting out. Sid Vicious is the name that he got the most mileage out of. Sid Justice and Psycho Sid. His son Gunner broke the news in a post on Facebook that his father passed away at the age of 63 after battling cancer for several years. He said he was known as Psycho Sid Vicious to the world, but to our family, he was simply Popper, the beloved grandfather. Sid was diagnosed with congestive heart failure in 2016 and atrial fibrillation, better known as AFib, around the same time. He was also given a pacemaker. In April 2021, he was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which was linked to Roundup Weed Killer. Although he never told anybody about his fight against cancer, he lived his life to the fullest, attending the gym, boxing classes, making appearances for his fans, and of course, t-ball games for the kids. He passed away peacefully in his bed, leaving behind a legacy of strength and determination. I've never met anybody with a fraction of the strength as my father. He truly was one of a kind. Sid was still out making appearances just a few weeks ago. He was in Charlotte at the Gathering, taking pictures and signing autographs. He wasn't just battling stage 4 cancer. He apparently had gotten COVID as well. That's what Bobby Fulton tweeted out, one half of the Fantastics. He was the master of the powerbomb. Two-time WWE World Champion, two-time WCW World Champion, and two-time WrestleMania headliner. Those were his only WrestleMania matches, and he headlined both shows. I got the chance to meet him once in late 96. He was champion the first time. I'll never forget when he pulled that Winged Eagle belt out of that black velvet bag. I was so mad. We didn't have a camera with us. I did get his autograph, but I didn't get any photos. Sid was actually studying to become a pilot before he got into wrestling. His father was a pilot, taught him how to fly. He was going to be a crop duster at the farm that he was working at in Arkansas when he had a chance meeting with Randy Savage at a gym. That would have been when Savage was working the Memphis territory. Savage and a bunch of other wrestlers, they were in the gym. They took one look at him and they asked him, they go, hey, dude, you ever think about getting into wrestling? Because like I said before, you take one look at this guy. He looks like a pro wrestler. And Sid hadn't watched wrestling since he was a little kid. But his wife was pregnant at the time, I think with their second child. And he thought, well, it's a way for me to make money. So that's how he got into the business. He has admitted in interviews that he didn't, you know, get into it because he had a love for the business or because he was such a big fan as a kid. He really just got into it to make money. And I think fans sometimes shit on people for that. Like Bill Goldberg has talked about that, how he got hurt playing football and his accountant was on him. Like, you gotta get out there. You gotta make money somehow. And so he got into wrestling. He never had a passion for it the way that a lot of other people do. And he gets shit on for that, you know, by some people. There's a lot of reasons you could shit on Goldberg. That's not one of them, though. I've never understood that. It's a job. Like, not everybody is cut out to be a wrestler, but others have certain physical gifts or they have an aptitude for it and they end up becoming big stars and very successful and making millions of dollars. Being a wrestling fan is not a prerequisite for becoming a professional wrestler. I would dare say some of the biggest legends of the business from when I grew up, and probably many of you grew up, right? The men that got me into wrestling probably did not grow up as wrestling fans. They were probably bouncing at a bar somewhere, or they were playing some other sport. And like Sid, they got noticed at the gym. Nothing wrong with that. I think that's why you hear about guys like Sid who bounced around different territories for different reasons. They did so, at least in part, because it was just a business to them. They were able to divorce themselves from that whole aspect. You know, guys kind of mark out or they're like, oh, you know, I always wanted to work for WWE. And, you know, they're willing to eat a lot of shit because this is their dream job and this is where they always wanted to be. But, you know, a guy like Sid, he didn't worry about any of that stuff. It's just a business to them. They weren't marks for it the way that a lot of other people are. They weren't marks for the promoter, you know, Vince McMahon or whoever. You know, they could play their Jedi mind tricks on them and get what they want out of these people. When you're unhappy at your job, what do? You quit and you go work somewhere else. So Memphis is where he got his start as Lord Humongous. And then it was on to WCW after that for his run with Danny Spivey. They were a tag team called the Skyscrapers. Before that, though, little side story that I always found very fascinating. Sid was one of two names that Antonio Inoki considered for the Big Van Vader gimmick before it ultimately went to Leon White. Inoki actually wanted Jim Hellwig to play Vader, which I just can't even picture that. But that fell through. Jim went to WWE as the Ultimate Warrior, and so his second choice was Sid. Now imagine Sid in New Japan walking around in that giant helmet. So Leon ended up getting the role instead, which is what made his entire career. And Sid ended up in WCW. He joined the Four Horsemen for a while. I shit you not, he joined the Four Horsemen to handle RoboCop. Yes, RoboCop was brought in as an ally of Sting's, and the very first promo that Sid ever cut as a member of the Horsemen, because I've been going back all this week on YouTube and Peacock and just kind of rewatching the hits and the not-so-hits from Sid's career, just kind of going down that rabbit hole. The very first promo Sid ever cut as a member of the Horsemen, he's out there in a tuxedo. He is towering over everybody, and he is cutting a promo on RoboCop. I love wrestling. The goofiest shit in the world, and I absolutely love it. Then he went on to challenge Sting for the World Heavyweight title. That was in 1990. This all happened in a relatively short period of time. I would say from the time he came into the NWA to the time he wrestled Sting for the world title, I don't even think it was 18 months. That's how over he got and how hard he was pushed in a relatively short period of time. In 91, he gave notice to WCW that he was leaving to go work for Vince McMahon. And they did everything they could to try to keep him. They gave him a big pay raise for guaranteed money and a promise of a world championship run, and he still left. He was lured over by the promise of a WrestleMania main event with Hulk Hogan, which he probably knew, hey, that can make me a lot more money, even though I'm probably going to lose. So he left guaranteed money on the table in one company to go lose to Hulk Hogan in the other. Now, Vince had no idea at the time that Ric Flair would suddenly become available a few months later. So when you wonder why Vince never went with the obvious Hogan-Flair main event at WrestleMania in 92, I mean, yeah, they claimed the house show business they did wasn't great, and they feared it wasn't going to draw as a WrestleMania match. The biggest reason, though, may have been that Sid was promised that match from the moment he signed, right? I don't know that he got it in writing. I mean, it's not like Vince McMahon hasn't promised things to people before and broken those promises, but if Sid came in with the promise of a match with Hogan, then those plans would have been in the works well before the show, regardless of Ric Flair coming in. Hogan versus Sid, when you think about it, though, Hogan versus Sid, honestly, was also much more of a WWF-style match than Hogan versus Flair. I mean, again, you just look at Sid, you could see why Vince would have had dollar signs in his eyes. Because remember, we were still in the era of the big man in that company at that point. 92 is where that first started to change with all the heat on them from the government, but it was still very much a big man territory up until that year. But he said that not taking the deal the WCW offered him and choosing to go to WWE instead, that was the biggest mistake he ever made. Because Vince had told him, you'll make more for WrestleMania than you will for an entire year working in WCW. He claims WCW was offering him $750,000 a year. I don't know how true that is, but he said he made $150,000 for that WrestleMania. So in his eyes, it ended up being a big mistake. But he didn't know that at the time, and so off he went. And they brought him in as Sid Justice. He was playing a babyface. He was the special referee for the match made in hell at SummerSlam that year, with Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior against Sergeant Slaughter, Colonel Mustafa, and General Adnan. That was the night that Vince either fired the Warrior backstage at the Garden when he got back through the curtain, or suspended him, depending on who you believe. I think it was a suspension, at least initially. But either way, we didn't see him again until WrestleMania the following year. That whole period is so fascinating to me, because heading into that SummerSlam in 91, the clear direction was Jake the Snake Roberts against the Ultimate Warrior. And I'm not even saying it would have been the SummerSlam match, but they had started airing this whole series of vignettes on TV with Jake teaching Warrior about the dark side. And Jake's entire life was the dark side. But that was the plan, for the two of them to feud until Warrior got fired or suspended or whatever. Had it happened, we likely never get the Randy Savage Jake the Snake feud, which is my all-time favorite short feud. So instead, they shoot the wedding reception angle with the snake popping out of the gift box and spooking Elizabeth, and then Jake and the Undertaker attack Randy Savage until Sid steps in to save the day and try to defend him. The plan then was for Sid to feud with Jake, with Sid taking Warrior's spot. And they even advertised the Team Justice against Team Roberts match for Survivor Series that year. But then Sid tore his bicep, and he was out for a few months. That then opened the door for a Macho Man return, because he had been retired. He lost that career-ending match to the Warrior at WrestleMania 7. He was doing commentary every week. Now, do I think he would have stayed retired? Of course not. But that's why he was rushed back for the program with Jake. So were it not for a series of unfortunate circumstances, things would have looked very different that fall, heading into WrestleMania. But it was during this period, right after he suffered the arm injury, that there was an infamous incident that took place. There were multiple incidents with Sid over the years, but the infamous squeegee incident took place right around this time. It's a great story. I've covered it before here on the podcast. Many years ago, WCW had a house show at the Omni in Atlanta. And it just so happened that the WWF crew had a show scheduled for the Omni the following night, So you had wrestlers from both companies that were in town at the same time, probably staying at the same hotel. And so they got together at the hotel bar. And Dave Penzer actually talked about this in his new book that just came out. He was the ring announcer for WCW. He said, Sid walked into the bar and he started bragging about how much more money he was making working for Vince and how I'm going to headline WrestleMania and WCW sucks and all this, you know, it's a country bumpkin promotion and all this stuff. As the story goes, Mike Graham, who was working for WCW at the time, he asked Sid, he goes, why are you here? And Sid said to him, you guys suck. You know, now Mike Graham, not known to be the calmest person in the world. He was known to be a hothead. He allegedly called Sid a steroid freak, said you can't work worth a shit. You'll never draw a fucking dime, which is funny coming from Mike Graham. But he told him, take your money, go home and play some fucking softball. Because Sid famously loved to play softball. He would disappear for months at a time and you would wonder, where's Sid? Oh, he's probably home playing softball. That's where softball Sid comes from. So this happens. Brian Pillman, he was there too. He was working for WCW. He may have also said something to Sid. They may have gotten into some words. He and Sid did not like each other. Sid hurt him in the War Games match earlier that year when he powerbombed him. The cage roof was so low. So when he brought Pillman down, he brought him down in such a way right on the back of his neck. He's lucky he didn't break his neck. I think Pillman only missed a few weeks, but he's very lucky he didn't suffer a more serious injury. Sid, by the way, claims he did that on purpose. He says that wasn't an accident. You would watch it and think, oh, it was an accident. Sid says it wasn't an accident. He says because what happened was there was a show not long before that. Pillman, I guess it was a house show. Pillman was whining to the agent about having to take his finish. Because all the guys complained whenever they worked with Sid in the Northeast because he would get cheered. This is what Sid claims. So I guess Pillman whining about it rubbed him the wrong way. And so a month later, he intentionally tried to fucking break his neck on the powerbomb. So anyway, no love lost there. Sid leaves the bar. He goes out to his car because he's got a torn bicep and he's not about to fight these guys. So he grabs the first thing that he sees. A squeegee. He comes back into the bar holding a fucking squeegee like it's a Smith & Wesson. Come on, motherfuckers, I'll kick all your asses. Penzer says everybody just paused for a second and then they all just busted out laughing. He said Sid could not get out of that bar fast enough. So that's where the squeegee Sid name comes from. Then came the greatest Royal Rumble match of all time. In 1992, the pop that Sid got that night in Albany when he dumped Hulk Hogan out of the ring and eliminated him was deafening. And the crowd booed Hogan loudly when he helped Flair dump Sid out of the ring. You would never know any of this if you watched the replay that they aired on Saturday night's main event a few weeks later because they dubbed the audio out. They dubbed out all the cheers for Sid. They dubbed in boos. They had Monsoon and Heenan lay down a new commentary track attacking Sid. How could he, you know, do this? He stabbed Hogan in the back, at least looked the man in the face. And even then, like, I'm a younger fan at that time. I mean, I'm not, super young, but I'm young enough. And I'm watching this and I'm like, it's every man for himself. What's he talking about? What's the problem here? I fail to see what the problem is. Like, how is Sid supposed to be the heel when Hogan just helped Ric Flair win the championship? That I'll never know. But that's what he was supposed to be, even though the fans weren't buying it. Even after the match. You know, Hogan and Sid, they came, you know, face to face. And the fans chanted for Sid. They chanted his name. Hogan looked shook. I'll never forget the look on Hogan's face. The man looked shook. And that wasn't even the first time that Hogan got a negative reaction. That was Survivor Series 2 months before this. When Undertaker pinned him and won the title, it got a noticeably positive reaction. Which is not to say that Hogan was booed everywhere he went, but, you know, people were getting tired of the shtick. They were growing tired of the same red and yellow, eat your vitamins, say your prayer stuff that they had been watching for years. Sid represented something new, and he just was a cool guy. But the plan was always for Hogan to wrestle Sid, even though they teased Hogan and Flair on TV. That was never the plan. Sid main evented WrestleMania with Hogan. He became the first man to ever kick out of the leg drop, even though it wasn't supposed to happen. Harvey Whippleman, who was managing Sid at that time, he was supposed to break up the pinfall, but he was late in doing so. So was Papa Shango. He was supposed to run in on the match. I don't know if it was supposed to be on that spot, but he got a late cue, and so he was still all the way down the aisle walking to the ring in this big stadium when all this stuff was going down. Now, there's two versions as to why Sid left the company in 92, because it was always a very weird thing the way he just sort of up and vanished. The belief has always been that he failed a drug test before WrestleMania, and they let him work the show because he was in the main event. They let him work the show, and they let him work the subsequent European tour, because back then they always had a European tour coming out of WrestleMania. And then the idea was that he would be suspended for a certain period of time. The last show he worked was in Boston against the Ultimate Warrior. And this is why it's so weird. If he failed a drug test, let's say in March or early April, and he was suspended, they let him work almost another full month. And the last show he worked wasn't even overseas. It was in Boston against the Warrior. Now, as Sid tells the story, he never failed a drug test. He's always maintained, nope, that's not true. I never failed the drug test. He said that it was over a disagreement with the Ultimate Warrior, where in the back before the show, and they worked a few nights, I don't remember which show it was, but before their match on one of the shows, they're in the locker room, and the Warrior told Sid, look, you're going to hit me with your finish, and I'm going to kick out of it, and then I'm going to beat you. Which is what he did to Triple H at WrestleMania 12, although Triple H was a nobody at that point. But this is Sid. Sid had just wrestled in the main event of WrestleMania. Sid was hardly a nobody. So Sid didn't like that, and he worked the match, and then he stormed out of the building. And that was the last anyone saw of him during that first run in WWE. So he showed up again the following year. He was probably under a non-compete. He showed up a year later in WCW, which is when he brought Booker T and Stevie Ray in from Global. Sid had worked there for a while in between stints, which is where he first laid eyes on Harlem Heat. And Booker has always been very open about how much he is appreciative for Sid, you know, for what he did for him and his brother. He got Harlem Heat their first big break. He even let them stay at his apartment during that time. Sid was scheduled to beat Vader at Starrcade in 93 to win the WCW championship. He was going to be their top new babyface, and that never happened. And the reason it never happened is because of one of the more infamous incidents in wrestling history. It was October 27th, 1993, at the end of the first night of a WCW European tour in the UK. Sid was at the hotel bar, as was Arn Anderson, and Sid made a comment about why he felt the company wasn't drawing. That it was because of old guys like Ric Flair, they won't step aside. Arn's version is that Sid was bragging about holding up WCW for a big raise, and that all these quote-unquote old fuckers need to retire. Meanwhile, Arn had just taken a $100,000 pay cut under Bill Watts the year before. And here's Sid talking, you know, gloating and talking about how he held him up to get an extra $100,000. So now Arn knows where that 100K went. So the two of them had words, and either Arn threw a beer at Sid's face or Sid threw a beer at Arn's face. Everybody got sent back to their rooms. Doug Dillinger was the head of security for WCW for many years. He was there. He intervened. Everybody went back to their rooms. Too Cold Scorpio, he went back to his room to go smoke some hash, as he tells the story. All of a sudden, he hears a commotion. Now, he's thinking it's Vader. Vader, though, is sleeping. So he goes downstairs. They were so loud. Whatever was going on was so loud, he could hear them one floor below. So he goes down one flight, gets in the hallway. He finds the hallway, the walls of the hallway and the floor covered in blood. It was like something out of a horror movie. And he looks and he sees Sid standing over Arn Anderson. Both of them are covered in blood. And Sid has a pair of scissors in his hand. So Too Cold rushes over to get in between them. He's a braver man than I would have been if I saw Sid standing there covered in blood with a sharp object in his hands. Sid looks down. He sees a hole in his stomach. Blood is squirting out of it. Now, by this point, Vader has been awoken from his slumber. He finally wakes up. He comes out of his room, nothing but his tighty-whities. There's a visual for you. And he finds Sid with blood pouring out of his stomach. So he does the only thing that he could think of. He takes his thumb and he sticks his thumb in the hole to stop the bleeding. Scorpio probably saved Arn Anderson's life. Vader probably saved Sid's, or else he would have bled out. Neither man pressed charges on the other. The police didn't charge either man since they were leaving the country anyway. Arn suffered 20 stab wounds with those scissors all over his body. Sid got stabbed 4 times. They were both lucky to be alive. All this over a stupid disagreement at the bar. I'm sure alcohol was involved. And this is what ended up happening. Sid got fired over the incident. He was on his way to a WCW title win. He was going to be the top guy. He got fired over the incident. He pissed away a $600,000 a year contract and a world championship run. Arn was not fired, although he was suspended. So that tells you who the company blamed for being the instigator here. And you would think, you know, after an incident like that, and Arn was, you know, even back then, I think Arn Anderson was pretty well-liked and well-respected. You know, one of the boys, one of the veterans. You would think that after an incident like that, nobody would want to hire this guy again. Nobody would want to work with him. But WWE came calling eventually. You fast forward to 1995, because he was working, I think, in Memphis in the meantime. And USWA, he became their world champion. But in 95... Vince came calling and they brought him in to be Shawn Michaels' bodyguard. This was the beginning of the Psycho Sid run. He turned on Michaels the night after WrestleMania. He got a few championship matches with Diesel. He was supposed to challenge Shawn for the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam, but the card looked terrible. So they bumped the match to TV, and instead they booked another ladder match between Shawn and Razor, which I don't want to say it saved the show because it wasn't a good show, but it was easily the best thing on the show by about 15 country miles. Sid got a neck injury. He missed some time, many, many months actually, before WWE came calling again because the Ultimate Warrior in 96 got brought back to the company. You can imagine how that was going to work out. Didn't take much time at all. He flaked out on the company. They fired him. And they needed somebody to take his spot, and that man was Sid. And whatever it was about that run in 96, that's the run where fans went absolutely nuts for this guy. He was ridiculously over in the summer and fall of 1996. He was over like Rover. The original plan for Shawn was to drop the world title to Vader at Survivor Series. Shawn didn't want to work with him. So Sid got the spot instead, and at Madison Square Garden that night, Sid had what has to be considered the best match of his career. They were not expecting the crowd to react the way that they did. But they cheered wildly for Sid, and they booed the hell out of Shawn. So you mean to tell me that New York City didn't want to cheer the dancing pretty boy over the cool badass monster? The hell you say. That's what happened. They cheered when Sid won the title, even though minutes before he hit a senior citizen in the chest with a television camera, who was now on the ground, twitching around, feigning a heart attack. And they still cheered this man. I remember Vladimir, the superfan in the front row, even leaned in to give him a big hug. He was so happy that Sid won. So he beat Bret Hart at the following In Your House pay-per-view. He dropped the belt back to Shawn at the Royal Rumble in San Antonio. He was scheduled to wrestle Shawn again on Raw the following month for the championship when Shawn famously lost his smile. And then he vacated the title. This was less than 6 weeks before WrestleMania that all of this happened. So the new plan was to put the title up at a four-way match, something we had never seen before. Triple threats and fatal four-ways just didn't happen back then. Not on TV, they didn't. Bret won the title. And then 24 hours later on Raw, he lost the belt back to Sid. And that's a whole other wild situation, the road to WrestleMania 13. Because originally it was supposed to be a rematch that year with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And Bret thought, okay, I'm going to be winning. because I put Sean over the year before. Now he's going to return the favor to me. Well, Sean didn't want to lose, right? Because Shawn Michaels doesn't lay down for anybody. Then, all of a sudden, he comes down with a potentially career-ending knee injury. Aw. Crocodile tears and all. And so Vince is like, well, fuck this shit. I don't need the drama with these two small guys. I'm going to go back to my tried and true, which is the big boys. And we got The Undertaker and Sid in the main event of WrestleMania. But that also gave us Bret Hart against Steve Austin on the undercard, which is one of the greatest matches in the history of that company. So I think it worked out okay. Interesting little factoid. Sid is the only man to beat Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels to win world titles. And he had the best matches of his career with both of them. And Sid didn't do too much after that. He was gone a few months later. He was out. He got a pretty serious neck injury after a car accident on the road and needed neck surgery, I think. He ended up in ECW a couple of years later, and he was every bit as over there as he was everywhere else that he had ever been. The fans loved him. And Paul Heyman knew how to use him. He would show up unannounced, and he would just powerbomb a bunch of guys, and people would go nuts. His run there didn't last long. It was only a few months before he wound up back in WCW, even with Arn Anderson working there. He ended up back in WCW, but they made amends. They were on good terms. They were cool with each other by this point, despite the attempted murder. Sid won the WCW title twice during that run. The thing I remember most was his feud with Bill Goldberg and the shot of him standing on top of his rental car, which had been crushed, I guess by Goldberg. He had used some kind of machine, and he had crushed Sid's car, flattened it into a pancake. And so Sid is standing on top of what's left of his car, screaming Goldberg's name, looking up at the heavens like, Goldberg! And like, why me? Why me? Like something out of a comedy film. The dying days of WCW basically was a comedy film. It was simultaneously a comedy and a tragedy. And then came the end of Sid's run, and the most horrific injury that I have ever witnessed in a wrestling ring. At the WCW Sin pay-per-view in January of 2001. It was a four corners match for the championship. Sid, Scott Steiner, Jeff Jarrett, and a mystery man who turned out to be Road Warrior Animal. Sid comes off the middle rope, which is something he never did. He was not someone who did moves off the ropes. But on this night he did, and when he landed, his leg snapped. He fractured his tibia. He fractured his fibula. I mean, I'm shuddering just sitting here talking about it because I don't even like going back and watching it. It's been years since I've seen it. It's just one of those injuries where you see it once and you wish you hadn't. Like, that's more than enough. And Sid has always blamed John Laurinaitis for making him do the spot. The idea was he would come off the middle rope and give Steiner a high knee. And Sid wasn't comfortable doing it. And he tried to get it changed. He voiced his feelings on it, and he claims that Laurinaitis insisted on him doing the spot. Basically, they were setting up a spot for Laurinaitis' brother, because Johnny Ace and Road Warrior Animal were brothers. And Road Warrior Animal was going to be the mystery man in this match, and so Johnny wanted to set things up just right for his brother. He wanted everything to go just right. Meanwhile, this guy's leg snaps. His boot is flopping around. Ugh, God, it's just... And you know what's extra shitty about it? That injury effectively ended Sid's career. Like, he never worked for a national promotion again after that. Now, he was already in his 40s at that point. I don't know how much longer of a run he would have had. I don't know if he was completely healthy, if Vince would have even brought him back. You know, there are certain people Vince McMahon did not bring back, but I guarantee you if Vince McMahon did not bring him back to WWE after WCW folded, if we would have had a Psycho Sid run or a Sid Vicious run in TNA. Like, that I guarantee you. So, but that injury was effectively it for his career. Now, he did eventually come back. He wrestled again years later. It took 3 or 4 years before he was back in the ring. He wrestled on the indies. I know he was hoping to get back to WWE. It never panned out. They did bring him back eventually for one match on Raw back in 2012. That was part of the build to Raw 1000. And he wrestled Heath Slater, and he won with the powerbomb. And that was it. Sid is the only man to have held the Winged Eagle belt from that era. Of all the guys who held it, and that belt was around for 10 years, the only man to hold that title who is not in the WWE Hall of Fame. That is insane. The last interview he ever did, shout out to the Attitude Era podcast. They were at a signing, and Sid was standing there, and they were able to grab him for about 5 minutes, and they did a little interview with him, and he said he thought with Vince McMahon being gone, now they would finally put him in the Hall of Fame, because they still had him under a Legends deal. You know, his attitude was, they got me under a Legends contract, they're making money off of me, maybe now they'll finally put me in the Hall of Fame. And now he's gone. No one is ever going to mistake Sid Vicious for being the best in-ring worker or having the best matches. He wasn't, and he didn't. And I say that as a fan of his. That's not what got him over. It was his look. It was his charisma. That's what made him so intimidating as a heel, but also made him so easy to cheer for as a babyface. You know, the guy looked like a badass. And his legacy is that wherever he went, he got over. In the NWA, when he would be on TV killing job guys, the people cheered. His first run in WWE, even when they were not supposed to be, the people cheered. When he went back to WCW in 93, the people went nuts for him. When he came back in 95 and he powerbombed Shawn Michaels, go look at that crowd, they cheered him. Comes back in 96, they cheered him. Goes to ECW, they lost their minds over him. Goes back to WCW, same old song. That's his legacy. That and him telling Kevin Nash on Nitro that he's got half the brain that Nash does. That's just one of those moments that you can't ever live that down. But over the past few years, you didn't really hear much about Sid. Every now and then I would come across, like on Facebook, there'd be some photos of him with his grandkids. He always looked happy, which is what makes this so sad. He seemed to be enjoying being a grandfather. At 63 years old, he didn't have nearly enough time to enjoy his golden years. I know a lot of his peers from that era never even made it into their 50s, let alone their 60s. So he's lucky in that regard. But it's still sad that he didn't get to enjoy more time as Sid the Family Man. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Let's start with an audio question.
Solomonster, it's me, Noah the Mark, from sunny South Florida. And, you know, I'm thinking if Randy Orton goes heel, hits that RKO on Cody Rhodes, if he really wants to be a heel, if they really want him hated, then he's just got to do one thing. Get rid of voices and go with a horrible Death Rebel theme. I mean, think about it. People would hate that, and they would hate Randy Orton because of it. What do you think? Also, by the way, we got to go to WrestleMania. Thanks.
You know, that's the best idea you've had in a long time, but it would be a sin to replace voices with a Def Rebel song. I hate that you even suggested it because it is a good idea. They'd probably, and like if you imagine what a Randy Orton modern day Def Rebel theme would even sound like, you know it would open with, in one of two ways. It would open with Viper or Apex Predator. They'd have that woman who does the beginning in Bailey song, like role model. They'd have some woman going Apex Predator. Oh my God. I hate it already. It just might work. Faisal from Kuwait. A lot of people were underwhelmed with Christian Cage winning the Casino Gauntlet match, but after Dynamite on Wednesday, I think it has the potential to work out in the end. Knowing the history between Christian, Jack, and Luchasaurus, I can envision a scenario where, at All Out, Jack Perry seemingly has Bryan Danielson beaten thanks to the Elite shenanigans, but Christian cashes in his poker chip to make it a triple threat. Due to a miscue between Christian and Luchasaurus, this then leads to Bryan Danielson getting the win by pinning Christian, screwing Jack out of the championship. On Dynamite, Jack calls Christian down to the ring, seemingly forgiving him for everything he's done to him, including what happened at All Out, teasing that they reunite to bring the belt back to the Elite and then hug it out, only for Jack to brutally attack him with Luchasaurus realigning with him as his heater. Christian would then remain off television until Adam Copeland is ready to return from injury, reuniting their tag team and having them feud with a heel, Jurassic Express, except now it'll be Jack Perry with his executioner, Luchasaurus. In the meantime, Jack can feud with Nick Wayne over the TNT title until Christian's return to television. I feel the patriarchy storyline is slowly jumping the shark, and it's time to shift Christian's story arc in a different direction. What say you? I like what you've outlined here. I really do. And I had not really thought too much about the connection between Jack Perry and Christian. So I could see something similar going down. As much as I love Christian as a heel, and I'm in many ways not ready for that to end. In other ways, I also feel like we've reached a point where are we, you know, at a stage where it's kind of diminishing returns from here on out. And maybe it is time, you know, and the time to do it might well be when Copeland is ready to come back. You know, Adam Copeland is off TV. He's out of sight, out of mind for a while. They do an angle with Christian. He gets destroyed. They both come back at the same time, right? And you ask why? Well, because they've been friends for 40 years. So, you know, all is forgiven. And we get an Edge and Christian team in AEW. And then, like you said, against Jack Perry and Luchasaurus as heels. And then any other number of matches you could do with Copeland and Christian against the Bucks, against FTR. I like it. I like it. I don't hate the idea at all. And I think Jack Perry having a bodyguard who's so much bigger than him to help fight his battles for him is another great way to get heat on him and reunite him in Luchasaurus, but without the goofy, you know, all the goofiness of him being Jungle Boy and all that. Although Luchasaurus is still wearing a dinosaur mask. So, I mean, maybe you get the mask off of him. Maybe we don't want to see him without a mask. I don't know, but I don't hate the idea. I think you may be onto something there. Jonathan from Erie, Pennsylvania. With Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley wrestling Dominic and Liv, it got me wondering if WWE would look to bring back the Mixed Match Challenge. Would you have any interest in that format returning, and are there any teams you would want to see put together? I don't have any interest personally in seeing them bring it back. I'm completely indifferent towards it. I don't really care one way or the other. I would like to see them do more mixed tag team matches on TV, though. I think that would be cool. Green from Morocco. Do you think Jack Perry is in a better place than he was since the Punk incident as far as being over? I personally think he did benefit from it and managed to use the negativity to get a little more over. I'm not saying he's this great heel now, but he has grown well into the role and is, at least in my eyes, more interesting than he was when his heel run began. Yeah, I don't think over is the right word I would use. I wouldn't call Jack Perry over. I would say he's in a better place than he was before, of course, because he was suspended and he was off television. He was doing nothing. Even before he had the incident with Punk, you know, it's like he had just turned heel not long before that. So he was barely into that run as a heel. So yeah, of course, now he's in a better spot. I do not attribute that to them airing the Punk footage. I still think that was very stupid. I think it was just a clear rating stunt. I think there were ways that you could have referenced the incident without building your entire show around airing footage of somebody who no longer worked for you. So my thoughts on that whole thing back in April haven't changed. But do I think he's in a little bit of a better spot than he was before? Yes. And it helps to be associated with the EVPs because it gets him more time on television. And he's the TNT champion. All of that stuff, his affiliation with the Bucks, have helped to get him in this spot where he is now. There are a lot of people who would love to have the television time that Jack Perry has. They would love to be the TNT champion. He pinned Bryan Danielson in Anarchy in the Arena back in May. They can use that now to promote his world championship match at All Out that he has coming up in less than a week. So, of course, he's in a better spot. But would I say it's a case where he's super over now, you know, even as a heel? I mean, he's hated, but I would be careful throwing that word over around as far as who's over and who's not. I don't know that I would necessarily use that word for Jack Perry. Daniel from Hamburg, Germany. Did you notice that Triple H had a long line of bad matches? after his second quad injury. I don't recall him having any really good matches until the Undertaker match at WrestleMania 27. DX tag team matches maybe not included. He wasn't the same performer in the ring as he was before the quad injuries. I mean, with each injury, he got worse. I'm not saying he had no good matches after that. He had plenty of good matches, but he just was not the same in-ring performer. It's why I often say 2000 to 2001, Triple H, pre-quad tear the first time, that was him in peak physical form. He was never the same guy after that. Ryan from Ireland. Another good place to have a WWE PLE. I'm sure it'll happen. We were going to get an NXT show in Dublin before COVID hit. Ryan says, this year marks my 10th year listening to the Sound Off, so I wanted to ask some decade-related questions. For you, what was the greatest decade in wrestling history? This is not restricted to the start and end of a decade. This can be any set of 10 consecutive years. For me, I would say 1988 to 1998. You could also say 87 to 97, but I would want that first like real full attitude year in there. I just remember how much fun it was to be a wrestling fan that time and the shows I would go to, and not only in WWE, but in WCW as well. WCW was hot. You know, the NWO was still kicking. Goldberg was getting over. DDP was over. There was a lot to love and a lot to like about wrestling back then. So I would say 88 to 98. Also, which wrestler has had the best or most influential 10-year span in their career? It's hard to vote against Hulk Hogan from 86 to 96. That would include the bulk of his Hulkamania run and his heel turn when he joined the NWO. You know, the business that he did for those two companies in that span of time, either 86 to 96 or 87 to 97. The business that he did in either of those periods is unmatched. And you talk influential, maybe Ric Flair. And then I would go Flair from 83, which was the Starrcade win over Harley Race. Again, I'd probably go from 83 to 93 Ric Flair, if you want to talk influential. I mean, think of all the classic matches he had during that period with not only Race, but, you know, Dusty and Funk. And the trilogy, right, with Ricky Steamboat, Ted Turner buying WCW. That deal was contingent, if I remember correct, on Flair being part of the company. And it was Turner's money that helped fuel the eventual Monday Night War. That doesn't happen without Ric Flair. I mean, if that's the case, if Turner wasn't interested in WCW without Ric Flair, and it was contingent on him continuing to be a featured part of the company. So Turner buys it. Now he owns WCW. And then you fast forward 6 or 7 years and we had the Monday Night War. I would say that that makes Ric Flair a pretty influential figure in wrestling history, wouldn't you? James from New York. Could anyone else have played the role of Stone Cold Steve Austin? More specifically, could any WWE star employed on TV and injury-free on the week that Austin debuted as the Ringmaster, given the exact same run, have gotten over the way that Austin did? Well, the honest answer is, we'll never know. Right? You can't be sure. I can't sit here and tell you with 100% accuracy that absolutely not. Nobody else could have gotten over as much as he did because we don't know. Sometimes somebody catches fire, you can't predict it. Now, if you ask for what I really think, the answer is no. Austin was the right guy in the right place at the right... You notice I didn't flub it like Hogan did, where he said the right gay guy in the right place at the right time. He was the right guy in the right place at the right time. And Austin just had a certain charisma about him and a certain swagger about him. It just... I don't see how it would have worked out the same way with anybody else in the company at that same time. But I can't be 100% sure. I would say I'm 98% sure of that. We'll leave open the other 2% because we just can't be sure. Luke from Slough, England. Having seen the potential death of the timeless Tony Storm character this past weekend, This got me thinking, for me, Timeless Toni Storm is the best female character that I have ever seen in wrestling. As someone who has seen far more wrestling than me, would you consider Timeless Toni Storm one of the best female characters in wrestling history? One of? Absolutely. Absolutely. For me, it's probably between her and Psycho Mickie James. I think I still put Psycho Mickie at the top. But Timeless Toni Storm, this character, was fantastic. And the way she played it, again, I don't think anybody else could have played it the way that she did. It's been a lot of fun. And Jose from Indiana, can you tell the story of how Taz and Tommy Dreamer almost got into a fight with Green Day? And what is your favorite Green Day song? I may be in the minority on this, pun very much intended, but my favorite Green Day song is Minority. I just think it's such a catchy song. I don't know if I'm the only one, by the way, but I definitely hear some Irish influence in that song. Maybe it's the accordion. Boulevard of Broken Dreams is probably my number two, and When I Come Around transports me right back to the 90s. As for what happened, I guess we're going to have to go back here. We take this back to the mid-90s. It's not really a huge deal. Taz was staying over in some dumpy hotel after a show, and it's the middle of the night. He wakes up. He goes downstairs. I think he wanted water, whatever it was he wanted. And the girl at the front desk, you know, gives him, I think, a bottle of water, and he's sitting in the lobby at 2 o'clock in the morning reading a newspaper. All of a sudden, a van pulls up to the hotel, and who comes out of the van but Green Day? So they go to the front desk. They reek of alcohol and God knows what else. And they start cussing this poor girl out because she can't find their reservation. There's some kind of problem, or they overbooked, whatever the issue was. And at this point, Tommy Dreamer walks into the lobby because Taz had gone back to his room after the show to go to sleep. Dreamer was out partying with everybody else. So Taz is chilling in the lobby in the middle of the night here. In walks Dreamer, and he gets just as upset as Taz at these guys cussing this poor girl out and giving her a hard time. And so by Taz's retelling of the story, and again, it's his version of events, he looks at Dreamer, Dreamer looks at him. They both walk up to these guys to try to get them to calm down. They have no idea who they are, by the way. I'm not even sure if by this point Green Day was that big of a deal. So it's not like they recognize who they are. But they walk up to Green Day. They try to get them to calm down. The girl is scared to death. And the smallest guy in the group, I remember him when he told the story. He said, the guy with the green hair walks up to them. It may have been the lead singer. Walks up to them and tells them to mind their fucking business. Now, how Taz didn't turn around and just smack the shit out of him, I'll never know. But Taz laughs and tells them that they're all going to end up in the ER if they don't calm down. The cops show up because the girl must have called them in the middle of all this. And that was it. That was the end of the incident. So they never even came to blows or anything like that. I mean, they almost did. It's actually a very tame story by comparison to a lot of the ECW stories from back in the day. But yeah, Green Day almost got their asses kicked for being a bunch of dicks. That's the moral of the story. Be nice to people. Treat other people the way that you would like to be treated. I think those are good words to live by. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com, for any potential mailbag questions. I can't get to them all, but I try to get to as many of them as I can. And if you have emails about anything else, that's where you can reach me. You could follow me on X, @Solomonster. You can, of course, subscribe to the YouTube channel as well, Solomonster Sounds Off. I am live multiple times every week, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, including this week. And again, it's going to be a very busy week because not only do we have Raw tomorrow night, we have Tuesday Night Titans. I'll be doing that on Tuesday. Wednesday is Dynamite. I fly out to Chicago for the House of Glory show on Thursday night, which I hope you will tune into or maybe come out to if you are in the area. SmackDown on Friday, we have All Out. Next Saturday, I'll be live on YouTube after that. And next Sunday, right back here for episode 878 of The Sound Off. And then I take a break. No, I'm just kidding. Because then it's Monday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday, and on and on and on. So, haha, I made it funny. As Splinter said, I'll see you guys next Sunday. Be well, stay safe, enjoy your Labor Day if you are, in fact, doing nothing tomorrow. That's the best thing to be doing. I'll be working, but I hope you guys have a great Labor Day and come on back for 878 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
No, it would be like eating a burger without the bun. That's like the new thing now, people. No bun. Really? Yeah, no bun. I'll have my hot dog without the bun. I'll have my burger without the bun. Unless there's like a medical reason for you not to have the bun. What the fuck are you doing? You have a burger on a bun. You don't put it on a plate and cut it up into little pieces.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster. Sala Monster sounds off.